Well, good evening. I'm hoping this sermon isn't delivered as difficult it was as preparing in some ways. I don't know, I'm sure several of you all remember a few years ago when Christian Bale came out with the movie Exodus, the story of Moses. And it was very developed. They spent a great deal of money promoting this film. They boasted a great number of actors, a highly touted writer and director and producer. And they built it up that this was going to be one of the great film events of that year it was released. But then after it, when it came onto the movie screen, just about everyone declared that movie was a disaster. You could read about it in the major news magazines. You could hear about it from people that you went to church with that went and seen the movie. You could hear it from people who have never even attended a church that didn't like that movie. Nobody seemed to like it. And what was it about that film that upset so many people? Well, for one, it was poorly written. It was badly researched. And really, the acting wasn't that great either. But I think more seriously for believers, there was a concern that this movie would influence people who had no church background, misleading and confusing them. I think we believers were uneasy because we are offended when people take liberties and make potentially damaging movies that could be had on people. When I take on or look at the subject of the rapture, I get that same kind of uneasiness. In some ways, you're glad because people are focused on the second coming of Christ and that it intensifies when they talk about this. And talk about the rapture reminds people that Jesus is coming. There are people that proudly display bumper stickers that say, in case of the rapture, this car will be unoccupied. Or in case of the rapture, someone please take control of this wheel. Or in case of the rapture, give my car to my brother-in-law. Well, you know, you have to be gratified by this sense of urgency that the talk of the rapture will create. The need to set life right with God that has been created. But there's a lot that bothers me with this discussion about the rapture. There is so much bad theology that surrounds what many people present and what people understand about it. To understand what lies behind the popular concept of the rapture, you have to go back to the book of Daniel and the interpretation there of its prophecies. And I hope I don't get us muddled down here. But these interpretations form the basis of what much is taught today in regards to the rapture. The prophecies of Daniel were written some 550 years before Christ. And one of the most significant is found in Daniel chapter 9, in verses 20 through 27. In Daniel chapter 9, beginning there in verse 20, he says, "While I was speaking and praying, confessing my sin and the sin of my people, Israel, and making my request to the Lord my God for his holy heel, while I was still in prayer, Gabriel, the man I had seen in an earlier vision, came to me in swift flight about the time of the evening sacrifice. He instructed me and said to me, 'Daniel, I have come to give you insight and understanding. As soon as you began to pray, an answer was given, which I have come to tell you, for you are highly esteemed. Therefore, consider the message and understand the vision. 77s are decreed for your people and for your holy city to finish transgression, to put an end to sin, to atone for wickedness, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know and understand this. From the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the Anointed One, the ruler, comes, there will be 77s and 62 sevens. It will be rebuilt with streets and a trench, but it will be times of trouble. After the 62 sevens, the Anointed One will cut off and will have nothing. The people of the ruler will come and will destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end will come like a flood. War will continue until the end, land, and desolations have been decreed. He will confirm a covenant with many for 1/7. In the middle of the seven, he will put an end to sacrifice and offering. And on a wing of the temple, he will set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that is decreed is poured out on him. Everybody still with me? And what the angel told Daniel was that this prophecy was to cover 70 weeks of years. Now, most conservative estimates of that recognize that to be about a period of 490 years. In the day of Daniel, Jerusalem was in ruins, and the Jewish people were in exile in Babylon. Daniel's prophecy was declaring that someone was going to decree that Jerusalem be rebuilt. The book of Ezra tells us that that someone was Artaxerxes in 457 BC. Furthermore, there the prophecy decreed that after the first 69 of those weeks, or about 483 years, the anointed one would arrive. Now, if you start at 457 BC and then you go and add 483 years to that, you end up with about 27 AD. Now, who do we think or believe began their ministry at about 27 AD? Well, we think it was Jesus. And if we go a little bit further and think about what the word Messiah means the anointed one. Daniel's prophecy is very overwhelming, really because of its extreme accuracy. God pinned it down to the year, and that's a phenomenal prophecy. But here's about where bad theology comes in. Many present-day teachers of the second coming believe that Jesus should have returned after the final 7 years of Daniel's prophecy, but that he didn't. And so they believe to think something has gone wrong. And that's what they teach. And that something that went wrong, they go with, was that the Jews rejected Jesus. And that this rejection was unforeseen by God. That God hadn't planned on this rejection, so he went to plan B. He went to the introduction of the Gentile church. And in doing so, God had to stop the prophetic clock. He had to postpone the fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy until the rapture would remove the Gentile church so that Israel could step into its rightful place in God's plan. Because how else can you explain that a period of over 2,000 years is going to take place in that 69 weeks of Daniel's prophecy and the final week there to describe it as stopping that clock? There's a couple of things that bother me with this. First, it bothers me that people would teach that something could happen that would be unforeseen by God. I think that bothers a good number of us. Second, I'm troubled that they would teach by inference that God wouldn't plan on the Gentiles being part of the plan. And the third thing is, it upsets me that anyone would consider that God wouldn't be able to realize that only a portion of the Jews in Jesus' day would accept Jesus. Now, why does that bother me? Why does that bother some of you? I think we can see the answer to that in Romans, the 9th chapter. In Romans chapter 9, verses 25 through 28, Paul there writes, as he says in Hosea, "I will call them my people who are not my people, and I will call her my loved one who is not my loved one. And it will happen in the very place where it is said to them, 'You are not my people.' They will be called sons of the living God." Isaiah cries out concerning Israel, "Though the number of the Israelites be like the sand of the sea, only a remnant will be saved. For the Lord will carry out his sentence on earth and speed with speed and finality." In other words, Paul there is telling us that the Gentiles were part of God's plan from the very beginning. They were not a parenthesis in God's plan. Gentiles were part of the plan, and the Bible tells us that they were. Another problem that comes up with this present-day rapture teaching is that it calls for a second and a third coming of Christ. Or, as minister and writer Jack Van Imp puts it, that there will be two stages of Christ's second coming. Well, that's interesting, because the way the rapture is taught these days, it would have to be a silent and secretive and unseen rapture. And you consider the general concept where there are two in the field, and poof, one disappears, and the other wonders what in the world happened, or that there are two in the car and one disappears, and the other struggles to gain control as it careens off the road. And then some 7 years later, after that final week in Daniel's prophecy, the revealing occurs when Jesus comes with all his authority and power. But the problem with that teaching is found in Matthew chapter 24. In Matthew chapter 24, verses 30 and 31, there Jesus says, "At the time, the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and the nations of the earth will mourn. They will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds and from one end of the heavens to the other." In other words, when Jesus comes to gather his elect, who's going to see him? Verse 30 says that all nations of the earth will see the Son of Man. And what's he going to do to signal his angels? Verse 31 tells us that a loud trumpet call. Second coming teachers like Van Imp and Hal Lindsey and others maintain that this rapture will be quiet. It will be shockingly mysterious. And it will lead to speculation by those who are left behind of what happened. Paul writes in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, verses 16 through 18, "For that the Lord himself will come down from heaven with a loud command, with his voice of the archangel, and with the trumpet call of God, and the dead of Christ will rise first. After that, we who are still alive and are left will be caught up together with them in the clouds to meet the Lord in the air, and so we will be with the Lord forever." That doesn't sound real quiet to me. It sounds pretty noisy and dramatic and overwhelming. God's intention will be to get our attention. In one of Jesus' parables, we're given a description of that final scene. In Matthew chapter 13, verses 24 through 30, and then 36 through 43, we're told the parable of the wheat and the tares. And Jesus explains it that Satan's goal is to sow weeds among God's faithful crop. And the inquiry is made that if the weeds should be removed, and the Father tells them no, because that if they do that, they might root up some of the good crop with the bad. And so they will wait till the harvest, and then the separation will occur. And when this harvest begins, if we look at that, you'll note who is taken first. It is the tares that are removed first. But isn't the normal teaching of the rapture that the good crop will be taken out and leave the weeds behind? That's not what this parable indicates. And what about Jesus' words in Matthew 24? Beginning in verse 36, there Jesus says, "No one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up until the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be in the field, one will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding at the handmill, one will be taken and the other left. Therefore keep watch, because you do not know on what day the Lord will come." Now, does this passage tell us or teach us that the good are removed and the bad are left? I don't know that it teaches us who's going to be taken and who isn't. There are a couple of factors in present-day rapture teachings that have overlooked the teaching of this passage. First, Jesus tells us that when the flood came, it took them all away in verse 39. Well, who did the flood take away? It took those that were not redeemed. It took away the evil people. And that same term, "took them away," is what Jesus used to describe those in the field and those people at the handmill. And so if we're going to be consistent on our handling of Jesus' teaching here, we have to conclude that he was proclaiming that the first rapture will of those who do not belong to God. Then God will gather those who are his sons and daughters in Christ. One man once observed that for Jesus to teach what modern day rapture teachings are, that he would have been better served to have used the example of Enoch or Elijah. They disappeared and were looked for, but were not found. Instead, though, a strict teaching of the Noah illustration leads us with the concept totally different than what is commonly held now. What does Jesus teach us about his second coming? Well, the first thing is he teaches us that he is coming back. And the second thing is his prime objective in coming back is to gather those in Christ. And when he does come, it will be in judgment. And the promise is true if you are not one that belongs to him, that punishment will follow. Tonight, the invitation is offered. If there is not anyone in Christ, we urge you to make that decision to come today as together we stand and we sing.